As wildfire hearings continue in Sacramento, we're getting a better picture of the WUI, the Wildland Urban Interface, with a focus on the role and responsibility of public utilities. Today on Insight, the president of the California Public Utilities Commission, Michael Picker, will talk with me about regulating utilities in this time of mega wildfires. Then the PolitiFact California team fact-checks a claim by Congressman Jeff Denham. It's about China and U.S. elections. In our second half hour, wine expert Rick Cushman talks about the smoky air we've had in the midst of the grape harvest and what impact that might have. And it's time again for the delicious Sacramento Jewish Food Fair. Owners of the Upper Crust Bread Company will share some samples. Can't wait for that. And later, music from the Sacramento band Animals in the Attic. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. California's public utilities are a critical voice in the state's debate about wildfires. And if you heard our program yesterday, you know that public utilities have essentially tripled the amount that they're spending on lobbying in light of changing wildfire policy. So from minimizing risk to responding to emergencies to assessing and determining responsibility for damages, public utilities have been in the hot seat, so to speak, and the statewide agency that oversees the utility companies is the California Public Utilities Commission. In the studio with me is the president of the CPUC, Michael Picker. Commissioner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. How much has the wildfire problem in California caught public utilities by surprise, in a way?
I think that the recent set of fires has caught everybody by surprise. So this year, it's not so clear that the electric utilities have a real role in the car fire up near Whiskeytown, and which burnt part of downtown Redding. That was caused by a vehicle. The fires then in Napa and Lake counties that became the Mendocino fire were started by apparently a guy with a hammer. One fire, and the other was started by a motorcycle. So the fires come from all different sources. About 1 in 10 in California seems to have some utility involvement. But what we're seeing is more fires, more ferocious fires, more drought, 10 years of drought, low soil moisture conditions, winds that don't have any humidity. And so overall, the ferocity of these fires, I think, is what's caught people by surprise. So the fires that we've been seeing in Northern California somewhat resemble more the Santana wind fires that we used to see more commonly in Southern California, with wind speeds that never have been experienced before. So for the electric companies, where we actually rated the pole infrastructure to starting with winds at around with wind speeds averaging around 60 miles an hour, that's the design standard, that no longer holds. So the infrastructure that we've been putting in the ground throughout the state of California for 80 or 90 years clearly cannot meet the advancing impacts of climate change. So that means that we're going to have to begin to adapt fairly quickly to an entirely new and unprecedented set of conditions.
What's your view of what happened last year in the Santa Rosa and Napa fires?
We don't have a complete picture yet, and to the extent that I do know things that are part of an ongoing investigation at the CPUC, I can't really speak about them. Eventually, we'll be releasing the results of our investigation. CAL FIRE has one set of rules that are in the California Public Resources Code. We have our own standards that are in the Public Utilities Code. To some extent, the CAL FIRE enforces to a hard and fast standard. The PUC has several broad standards that we will enforce to. Theirs is they have the ability to make referrals on criminal charges that are in the public code, the public resources code. We tend to use civil remedies. So there's differences as state agencies. At the same time, there overlaps. That's one of the reasons why over the past 10 years, but particularly in the last 5 years since I came to the CPUC, we've been building very close relationship with CAL FIRE to the point of actually having legal agreements that specify how we will actually work on these issues together. Again, we have different legal codes, but we have overlaps in terms of what we do. So one feature that I point to is that in the last 5 years, we've been working very closely to create a new fire map of the state.
With CAL FIRE.
With CAL FIRE. And they have fire scientists, they have fire engineers, they have people who are in the field looking at fuel. We tend to look at utility infrastructure.
And let me pause you there. How much did you know about fire, forest science coming into this job?
Me? Nothing. I knew about energy policy.
And so
I know about infrastructure.
And CAL FIRE now is telling you that 44% of the state's land mass is in a high-risk area. And you have amazing statistics in terms of the network of wires and poles that cross over that area.
Well, when we started this process, they gave us an interim map, and it basically designated about 30% of the 17% of the state's land mass as being in a high fire hazard or extremely high fire hazard area. That's now grown to 44%. That's about 1.4 million structures, 4 million people. We expect that as people move more and more and more into these fire hazard areas, that'll be 5 million people by the end of this decade. So that's one of the other changes we're seeing, is that people move more into this wildland-urban interface at the same time that it is expanding, and the amount of fuel seems to be increasing.
What's your sense of responsibility for this WUI, the wildland-urban interface, the responsibility of the safety of people in it?
Again, there are a number of overlaps between us and CAL FIRE. I think that there's a different piece of it that really is at the heart of what it is the Public Utilities Commission does, which is that we have in California law something that's described as the obligation to serve. So there was time when there was intense competition in the electric industry, but not everybody had access to it. And so in order to be more efficient and only have one set of poles on a street rather than three or four serving different customers, we created in California law what we call a monopoly. And that monopoly was a more efficient way to build very long, linear, and long-lived infrastructure, similar to the railroads. But it has to serve everybody. And we actually make the utilities build electric lines to serve communities that are building in the wildland-urban interface.
With you saying that, and excuse me for the interruption, but I do want to go to a bit of your testimony from July 25th. This is you speaking at the conference committee hearing, and you are speaking exactly to this point.
So when people move further out from dense urban concentrations, their need and their demand for electricity and telecommunication infrastructure continues. We don't tell them to move there. We tell the utilities that you have an obligation to serve. You have to provide them with that infrastructure.
Might that change someday? Could you foresee a time when infrastructure can't follow where people move to and the risk is too dramatic?
Well, I talk about that. That will require legislative changes, but it'll require cultural changes. People expect that. We get more calls complaining about the fact that the utilities sometimes shut off power to areas that are at risk of fire or where there are high winds because they are concerned that their infrastructure might be creating a hazard. We get more calls about that than people call saying that they're concerned that electricity infrastructure is being built in those high-risk areas. So people just have an expectation. It's built in. We all think and know that when you move someplace, you will get telecommunications, you will get
electricity.
Get electricity.
Yeah. when you were listing statistics and you said the number of housing units and people that live in the risk area, one fact that's gotten some attention is that you say you have 1 million wooden poles in that area or telephone poles?
There's more like 2 million wooden poles. Poles are very important. They are the best buy in all of your infrastructure in the state of California. They bring you not only electricity, but they also bring you two or three types of telecommunications and sometimes competing telecommunications. So you can get internet, you can get voice, and you can get content, as in AT&T's UVerse or Comcast's Infinity. So Xfinity.
But you also say that these are the biggest challenge for the PUC.
Well, we have a lot of challenges. We cover Lyft and Uber. We cover railroads. We cover light rail. We cover certain
kinds of bus. Is there a dilemma with the poles then?
Well, if you continue to build new housing out into wildland areas that are subject to fire risk, and people have a right to have telecommunications and electricity, and we continue to build poles and wires, there's going to be conflicts. There's going to be risk.
I think we've spent the first part of this conversation laying out somewhat of the new job in front of the PUC in this new normal era now of wildfires. But there's a lot of legislative focus at the state capitol right now, and I'll let everyone know that I'm talking with the president of the California Public Utilities Commission, Michael Picker. So let me shift to some of the legislative focus, and that is, do you support the governor's and PG&E's proposal to change the liability laws?
Well, it's not clear to me that everybody speaks about things in the same way, but we definitely think that the governor has a reasonable package of increasing the protections and starting to figure out what's the right way to share liability for this increased fire risk from utilities. It doesn't actually help with the risk from these fires that are started by other sources, however.
Is some part of the governor's proposal already DOA? Some of it is alive and some of it people are just turning away from already, but not publicly.
I think that there are a lot of ways that the legislature could approach this. The governor laid out a package that makes sense to me. But as to what happens this week and next week, you got me. I don't try to judge the legislature in advance.
You know that critics say that package is to some degree a bailout for PG&E.
Well, the piece that people say that about is this concept of inverse condemnation. And that's court-made law based on the state constitution. And so the reason that the courts made the utilities the first payer is that they had sort of a flawed notion, but they also had a problem, which is they don't want all these claims to end up in the superior courts. It clogs up everything else the superior courts do. So what they said is the first payor in any case where there's any involvement of utility infrastructure in starting a fire will be the utilities. They pay everybody off, then they go collect from everybody else, and if there's any residual expense, then they go collect that from ratepayers. So that's been the way it's been for 80 or 90 years. It doesn't work that way in other places. It's usually the insurance company who are their first payers. So when I look at this, what I see is very large interest groups all pointing fingers at each other saying, well, you should pay first. That's what I see.
Meanwhile, lawmakers are discussing the question of whether utilities could go insolvent because of liability to wildfires. But then the bankruptcy talk could be a bluff too, couldn't it?
I tend to think that bankruptcy does not necessarily mean the only solution. I think that what I do fear is that there will be cash shortfalls. So if a utility has to pay a lot of these claims, but they can't recover their costs except over a longer period of time, then that means that there's a lot of money going out now, but they don't collect except for a long period of time. Usually what the utilities do, because that's a pretty common situation for a utility, they spend a lot of money on infrastructure, then they collect it through rates over time, is that they borrow money. If, in fact, there's a cash shortfall, as some utilities seem to be experiencing, PG&E has missed two shareholder payments, all those shareholders, all those bondholders get quite nervous. And what happens is share prices drop and bond costs go up. When that happens, it goes to ratepayers. It always goes there. And I worry that in this era of potential cash shortfalls, that some of the utilities may come back and to us and say, look, you know, we're really having a hard time raising money. The cost of capital is going up. We're going to postpone building new battery storage or new electrification of transportation because we had to tend to the core mission of serving customers. So those, I think, are pretty likely cases that we may see. But a utility could decide that rather than being the first payer, they'll go to a court. They're going to say, we want to file a form of bankruptcy. You figure out who gets paid. So you go back to the same thing. But it probably will happen in federal court rather than state courts because the state courts have already said, we don't want that. We're not having any of that. We don't want to have to settle this stuff. So if it goes to the federal courts, that's a different kettle of fish for Californians.
What do you think ultimately is right in terms of liability? Is there a sharing formula that seems to make sense to you?
Well, I'm more of an infrastructure person, and so the morality of liability law is really tough for me to address. I can't think of it that way. It's how do we build the infrastructure that we need for Californians to continue to prosper? How do we build the infrastructure we need to make the state go? I frankly think that if we want the utilities to continue to play that function of borrowing money cheap and getting infrastructure to scale really fast, we're going to have to pay some attention to how they actually can borrow to do those things that the state of California needs them to do. So it's a much more functional perspective on it. I think that as local governments make decisions about putting new housing and new communities in high fire hazard areas, they have to think carefully about whether they want to expand that risk. If they make the choice to do that, do they bear some of the liability?
So zoning laws and building codes are critical.
Right. If, in fact, climate change is a piece of this, should we start to think about how we share risk and liability differently? Do we need to have a fund that covers the massive kinds of damages that come with a changing climate and changing environmental impacts from that climate?
If, in fact, climate change is part of this? Do you want to clarify why you're making the statement that way? Are you questioning the science?
I am not questioning the science. But in any given event, it's not always easy to say that a specific weather event, a specific windstorm, is related to the changes in climate. I think that that's a challenge. However, climate scientists are saying that these recent fires are attributable to climate change. That's a distinction that I think we have to be very careful about because we don't want to allow people to use climate as an excuse for failure to do everything that they can and should do.
I do want to return to one point. Just as you were mapping out your view from an infrastructure and your background from an infrastructure standpoint, earlier in this conversation we were talking about the fact that fire science and forest management wasn't your arena anyway. Doesn't this speak to the changing role and the nimbleness that CPUC has to have? And maybe what we need is an overall fire institute where all this collaboration and communication addresses this major problem.
Well, it's just human nature to focus on the last thing that happened. It tends to really focus our attention. And I think that these risks that we're seeing from fires are only several, one of the several kinds of hazards that are likely to come as we see advancing climate change. And so the California Coastal Commission, responding to a mandate from the legislature to begin to plan adaptation for changing climate, started to look at sea level rise and started to say that coastal communities shouldn't build in some lower areas. That's created a huge backlash in portions of coastal Southern California. I think that flooding and sea level rise are going to be an issue here in Northern California. We know that less precipitation will fall and continue to be held in the Sierras as snow. That snow is a storage facility. It prevents early flooding, but right. It also helps us with water throughout the year. I think all these things are issues that we have to address at the same time.
We're out of time here. I haven't noted that you have made dramatic changes in de-energizing distribution lines during windstorms. You've talked about the collaborative effort, the wildfire response. Can you ever do enough to keep people safe now?
I worry that as hard as we've worked over the last few years with CAL FIRE to develop better fire maps and a very expensive new vegetation program that's the toughest in the nation, the amount of time we spent looking at what changes they've made in Australia, both we at the PUC and our counterparts in Australia think that we are still behind the pace of change in the climate and conditions that we're trying to protect people against.
I appreciate your time, Commissioner Picker. I'm glad we had this conversation. I look forward to more dialogue as this continues for us.
Give me a call. I'd love to come back. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is the president of the California Public Utilities Commission, Michael Picker. We'll post links to related stories. And again, those hearings continue at the state capitol, which our capitol team continues to cover in our state government news as well. It's all at capradio.org. And this is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruiak. Do you remember President Trump referencing that China might have tampered somehow with the 2016 election? Well, Congressman Jeff Denham from California also talked about China and elections tampering recently. And his comment was picked up by the PolitiFact California team, which has fact-checked it. Reporter Chris Nichols is in the studio with a rating. Hi, Chris. Glad to have you here.
Good morning, Beth. Great to be here.
I would like to clarify that President Trump and Congressman Denham did not say the same thing.
That's right. Trump has made comments suggesting China could have been responsible for the 2016 election interference, and Denham's claim was much more broad, did not give any sort of time frame for when China allegedly tampered with U.S. elections.
We are in a season of highly competitive House races, a lot at stake, so that alone might say why you'd focus on something Congressman Denham said. Do you want to add to that?
Well, that's right. We're looking at some of these very competitive House races across California. There are five that are now considered, that are so close, they're considered toss-ups. And Denham's District 10 in the Modesto area is one of those.
So let's listen to what he said, and then we'll talk about the fact check.
You know, China's been a good partner on a lot of issues. They've backed us up with North Korea. You know, they are a good trading partner, even though they've not acted so well with our elections. They've tampered with our elections quite a bit.
And that was the phrase right there, right?
That's right. Tampered with our elections quite a bit. So that definitely caught our attention. Everybody knows about Russia and the conduct when it comes to the widespread interference in the 2016 election. China has just not come up too much other than the comments by our president. And so we wanted to see if there's anything to this.
You always reach out to the office to begin with. So what happened when you contacted the congressman's office?
We received essentially a list of news articles, government reports that do outline threats when it comes to China's cyber capabilities, its espionage threats, its theft of intellectual properties. These things are very real concerns, but we did not see any material that even alleges tampering by China in U.S. elections.
You reached out to a number of experts to ask about this as well.
We did, and the experts really sort of drew a distinction here. They talked about efforts by China to lobby U.S. politicians. There's certainly a lot of that that goes on. There are efforts to influence America's political process, just like other countries do that. But they drew the distinction and said that they have not seen evidence of tampering. One of those experts is Yoshiko Herrera. She's a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and she has studied Russian election interference.
And we have a clip from your conversation with her.
I don't think that there's any evidence of China as a government acting to interfere in the elections in order to either disrupt the process or to tip the election one way or the other. Tamper suggests breaking into something or inappropriately changing something. Now, it doesn't suggest just buying influence, for example.
There's also more fact-checking on this point. I think that you saw work that had been done by the PolitiFact Wisconsin team.
That's right. There was a similar claim about a year ago by then White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, and he said at that time, summer of 2017, that it was an absolute fact that China, and he also mentioned North Korea, had consistently meddled in U.S. elections for many, many years. And our colleagues at PolitiFact Wisconsin, which is another PolitiFact affiliate, checked that out, contacted a dozen international affairs experts, including some of the same ones that we followed up with, and they rated that false.
All right. So with it all said, in terms of Congressman Denham's claim, what's the rating?
Well, again, without any evidence, without even any allegations, that credible allegations that this has been happening at PolitiFact, when there's simply no evidence, we rate things false. And that's the rating we placed on Denham's claim.
And is this fact check complete and posted on the website at this
point? It is. It's okay. At politifact.com/California.
And there's a link to so much work by the National PolitiFact team. And let me also promote that you have a busy day today. You're on your way to a speech.
That's right. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy will be speaking later today in Sacramento. We will be attending that and listening for any possible future fact checks.
Okay, Chris. Always great to have you with us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Beth.
Chris Nichols is the reporter for the PolitiFact California team that's based at Cap Radio. And you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. This is an intense time for winemakers and for workers in the fields. Add to that the fact that we've had these major wildfires with smoke and ash and haze in the air. So I asked wine expert Rick Cushman about the impact on the ripening grapes, and he actually started by reflecting on the wine country wildfires from last year.
Let's go back almost a year ago to October last year. As central as those fires were to Napa and Sonoma wine country, there was two good things about that if there were good. One was that a lot of grapes were already off the vine, and the grapes that were on the vine were thick-skinned and had already gone through everything, so they were picking up less of the atmospherics.
Right, I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Right now, most of the grapes go through what's called veraison. That's when the grapes change colors. So, you know, the red grapes are green until late July, mid-August or so, depending on the grape or the variety. So they're very susceptible right now. The problem, well, the uncertainty, I should say, is that, you know, you look at Napa and Sonoma, there, it's a lot like here in Sacramento, you know, with that exception of a day here and a day there. We don't see ash. There's just this high smoke that really wouldn't affect the grapes. So for Napa, Sonoma, our friends in the foothills, Lodi, foothills might be getting more of it because they're up higher and they're more into it. But it's just so hard to know right now. You know, fingers crossed the impacts will be minimal on the vintage in terms of, you know, smoke taint. I mean, if there's a tiny, tiny bit in the grapes that comes out, and the thing is, there's a tiny, tiny bit in the grapes, it may be no problem at all. The problem with smoke taint, and once again, remember this from last year, is it's not really something you can test for, and it's not something you can taste right off the bat. So often winemakers are in there and they're tasting, you know, they're chewing the grapes, tasting the grapes, and then they're tasting their early wines even before they're finished, and then they're tasting when they go in a barrel, and they taste them through the process. I mean, they taste constantly, and they can't tell. But maybe a year later, it starts to show up.
That's if the air is smoky.
If the air continues to be smoky, yeah.
You just mentioned ash. Is the effect different if there's
ash? Well, ash is worse. The thickness of the ash just makes it that much more worse because that stuff is going to land on the grapes and the grapes are going to absorb some of it. And the ash is also, it's your marker of how bad the smoke is.
Then that becomes the flavor of that vintage.
Well, so this is the fun, weird, bizarre, sort of charming thing about wine. We talk about this notion of terroir, which is nobody's really ever quite defined it, but it's like the place, the people, the time, right? They're going to taste like 2018. And if it's not horrible, so okay, you have this layer of smokiness that says this was 2018. If it's there, I don't want to condemn the vintage yet. Just like 2017, we really don't know yet. I mean, most of those wines, the wines that were out in the fields in 2017 during the wildfires, those stuff, we're not going to see those for another 6 to 18 months.
So the mystery of the impact continues. That was wine expert Rick Cushman. You can find this month's longer version of Cushman by the Bottle online at capradio.org/insight. Now we're going to shift from wine to food. The studio smells absolutely fantastic. It's the annual Sacramento Jewish Food Fair. It happens later this month on Sunday, August 26th. But this is the perfect time to place your orders if you're not going to get there. And in the studio with me is the co-chair of the festival, the very experienced and great cheerleader for it all, Lydia Ingram. Hi, Lydia. Glad to have you
here. Good morning, Beth. Thanks for having me back.
And I know your co-chair, Sheila Wolf, is celebrating her birthday and not with us.
She is sorry to miss this.
Send her a happy wish. We also have from Upper Crust Baking Company in Davis, and what an amazing addition to the food fair, Mo and Lauren Kaliski. So, Mo, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Lauren, glad to have you here as well.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Is this a true old story then, that when you got out here, Mo, there just wasn't bread to your satisfaction?
That's right. We had come out here to go to graduate school at Davis.
You and your wife, Trudy.
Yes. There was no bread. And Julia Child had just come out with her second book that says how to make French bread at home. And I said, hey, that's a challenge. And so I figured it out. And so for many years, I would make bread for my family. Many years later, people were saying you should open a bakery. And so we did in late 1986. We opened a bakery, and the rest is history.
Lauren, what's your view of it, growing up in the household and being taught this craft, this art?
Yeah, well, it was my first job when I was 16 years old, and it's something that's always been very close to my heart. And my life kind of took an arc that took me away from Davis for many years, and I've been back there for about 3 years now and getting back involved with the bakery. And it came at a good time because my folks are happy to semi-retire a little bit. And
that'll never really happen. You know that, right?
it's a difficult process for sure.
So, Lydia, what's the importance of Jewish corn rye? And that's part of this partnership here with Upper Crust.
Yes. Again, there is no true Jewish corn rye, which has a hard crust, soft and chewy with caraway seeds, or actually you can buy it without caraway seeds. But it's sort of a staple. And we are so thrilled that we've been working for the last several years with Mo and Lauren to develop this, and now we have it, and it's being made just for the Jewish Food Fair right now.
What was the challenge, Mo, in making this, and is there something secret about the process? Like, you'd even tell me. I know you wouldn't, but...
Well, no, baking is not rocket science. It really isn't. It's all about the process. The ingredients are fairly simple. In fact, the bread that we first started to make, French bread, French baguettes, back in 1986, there are only four ingredients: flour, water, yeast, and salt. It's all about the process. The rye bread is it's just a matter of getting it, getting the various parts of it working together. It needs to have a chewy interior. It needs to have a hard crust. It needs to have cornmeal underneath.
Which
and it
is
needs
it?
To have the right flavor.
It's this one right here.
It's this one right here?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I have to start there.
And I think the beginning of any new product is a demand. And there has been a growing demand for this. And it came out of the food fair. We saw when we imported it from Los Angeles, because there was nothing here, we saw the growing need. And we would sell out every year within the first couple of hours. And that's when we realized we needed made here locally.
This is amazing bread. It is not that dark brown color of rye. So I expected to taste a little more corn to it. It is the most rich, fresh rye I have ever tasted.
Thank you.
I'm not fibbing either because I really am surprised. And it is a lighter color. It's a beautiful bread. Is it not a regular recipe for you?
We do make a rye bread that it's part of our regular production that we sell at all the farmers markets that we go to. But the rye bread that's in our regular production is a little bit different from this. It's more of a sandwich bread that has a softer crust. It doesn't have the cornmeal on the bottom. So this is really what you would traditionally find in a delicatessen. Wow. The bread that we sell on a regular basis at the farmers markets is one that's a little bit more adapted for sandwich breads
when bread doesn't need butter or jam or mustard or anything with it, then you know that it is truly delicious. Mm-hmm. All right. And Lydia, you know what I'm going for here.
That is what we call noodle kugel. It's right. Like a noodle casserole. It has cheese in it, cottage cheese, sour cream, sugar, and so on. This is a sweeter one. There are more savory kugels.
You need to come to my house and make this and teach
you
me
you just
how
name
to make
the
this.
Time. I'll be there.
Okay.
Because this is like one of a standard. Our byline for the Jewish Food Fair is from generation to generation. And, of course, Mo and Lauren really fit that well.
Absolutely.
And Lauren's 11-year-old daughter is here as well.
What's her name?
That's Tess, and I have
Hi,
another
Tess.
Daughter.
Hi, Tess. She's waving to us through the window and recording Dad and Grandpa.
So yeah. They really are, they fit into our view of for the past, the present, and the future. And for instance, these
keep
recipes
talking, Lydia.
Here are
eating.
From my mother, the cabbage rolls, the noodle kugel, a lot of the sweets are. And then one gal I work with has her mother's recipe, who you made it for 40 years, the chopped liver. So that was a chopped liver recipe for 40 years.
I know you bring cabbage rolls, and we've talked before about how many cultures have a
yes.
variation of the cabbage mm-hmm. rolls. Mo, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York.
Yeah, and were cabbage rolls a part of your life, your mealtime?
Yes, absolutely. It's something that you don't eat on a regular basis, but on special occasions you get that. And
I started growing cabbage in my garden just to have the fresh cabbage for the cabbage rolls. Wow, that's delicious.
And this is made with ground beef, and I grew up with that in Boston. But I've also made it with turkey. Ground turkey, and it's just as good because the flavor really is in the sauce. It's a sweet and sour sauce, and it's delicious.
And there is a sweet and sour. And Mo and Lauren, you have to forgive me because she really comes to feed me every year. I absolutely love it. But you have some remarkable rolls here with an onion topping that smell just divine. So this is a specialty, isn't it, for upper crust?
This is something we do on special occasions, for sure. It's not part of our regular production, but it could be in the future. We're definitely doing it for the Jewish Food Fair. They're little onion buns or onion rolls that make great buns for sliders. They're really yummy just eating on their own.
I'll take a whole pan. Right now, I'll absolutely take a whole pan. They're amazing. Would you clarify for me? Excuse me, I am talking with my mouth full, and I can't help it. I really apologize. Clarify about ordering in advance and being able to get what people would like at the fair, too.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. August 19th, this coming Sunday, is the last day to pre-order. People pre-order because there are certain things. If you go online at jewishfoodfair.com, you'll see that the listing of foods to purchase. People know that certain things sell out fast, and if they can't get to the fair later in the day, they will pre-order to make sure that they have what they want. A lot of all the foods, are sold at the fair until they sell out. So we encourage pre-orders.
I want to brag about you a little bit, Mo and Lauren, because you have been the bread supplier for the Tower Bridge dinner. And a huge network of, you said farmers markets, but how many farmers markets?
Yeah, we go, this summer is our biggest summer yet, and we're doing close to 50 farmers markets all over the region from the Bay Area.
You're featured in the Davis Farmers Market Cookbook, which is a popular and beautiful book.
Beautiful book, absolutely.
And I think that there are so many different places that people have been able to get on location your breads. What about a store? What about your own retail store?
Well, we used to have a couple of retail stores in Sacramento years and years ago. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, we had a store in Old Sacramento, and we had a store at Town and Country Village. But we pretty quickly decided to focus on farmers markets. And now we're opening a new store in Davis. We're in the process right now of building a bakery, a production bakery and retail storefront right next to the Davis Food Co-op. So we're really excited about that. And that's scheduled to open in just a couple of months, probably by October 1st.
What bread am I eating right now, Mo? I think you're a saint.
It's the pumpernickel.
Raisin pumpernickel. There's almost more raisins than pumpernickel in that.
All right. So the Jewish Food Fair is Sunday, August 26th. Location?
It is 4746 El Camino near Mission. Mm-hmm. It is free admission and free parking. And there are close to 40 craft vendors with unique crafts. Most of everything at the food fair is homemade. And when we can't supply enough, then we have brought in vendors like Upper Crust to provide foods that we can't bake, like the bread. Not in quantity, anyway.
Well, Lydia, it's always a pleasure to have you here. I think the food's better this year than it's ever been.
Thank you. Well, we certainly improve everything.
Tess, are you baking bread yet? No? All right. Lauren, you need to teach the next generation,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
And Mo, I think you should come back and tell more of the story, okay?
Sure.
You're welcome. You and Trudy are welcome here. Of course, you can always bring bread, but it's not necessary.
There are lots of stories. We've been doing this for 30-some-odd years. And there have been a lot of stories along the way.
That's Mo Kaliski, Lauren Kaliski, the Upper Crust Baking Company in Davis, and Lydia Ingram with the Sacramento Jewish, 41st year of the Sacramento Jewish Food Fair. There's more at capradio.org/insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak, coming into the studio now. The band behind that music, they are Animals in the Attic. They are just back from a month of touring the West Coast and Texas. They think they've hit the jackpot today with the Jewish Food Fair here right before them. Yeah. Isn't the studio full of wonderful treats?
Wow, it was amazing.
Yes. Hi, guys. Glad to have you all here. Yeah. And we're all kind of nestled in between the keyboard and the chords and the equipment, so thanks for bearing with us today. Congratulations. How was the tour? You know what? Why don't you start by introducing yourselves?
Yeah. Right. My name's Spencer. I play guitar and vocals.
I'm Jeff.
I'm Clayton. I play the keyboards.
Yeah, I'm Stefan. I play guitar.
Jeff plays the drums.
Cool. And thanks for having us.
Yeah, so glad to have you here. So how was the tour? You were up and down the West Coast, and you have a big following on Spotify, a big following on Instagram. So what'd you learn about playing music for your fans?
It was quite an experience. I mean, we set up the whole tour ourselves, so it took a long time just emailing people nonstop and finding the best venues in each town. And, you know, even with the following we have, some shows would be a small turnout and some shows would be a large turnout. So it just depends. And we'd hand around flyers in towns before shows and do everything we could. And it was super fun the whole time. all good vibes.
Was money the reason that you did it in such a DIY way?
I maybe when it comes down to it, you know, we don't have, we're totally independent at this point. And so, yeah, I guess, yeah, we kind of just, we saved up some money from our jobs and we're like, screw it, let's hit the road.
All right, somebody has to define indie surf pop chill wave. Because genres have gotten so creative. They're like labels on wine bottles, you know? They're so artsy. So
yeah, true.
What is your sound and what does that phrase mean?
I think you guys are better.
Clayton, wait, try it. What do you think? Oh, how would you describe chill wave?
How would I describe
your music?
Our music? We just add like a lot of dreamy synths and nice like just riffy like guitar with like lead guitars and stuff. I don't know. Yeah. It's just the combination of stuff makes it really sound really chill.
And you're Stefan, right?
Yes, Steph, correct.
So Stefan. Add to that.
Yeah, I guess another big part of the sound is I guess just like jazz chords. I know.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Like adding extensions to the chords. That's another part that makes our music sound like it does. Adding sevens, nines, stuff like that.
Okay, have they set up the music enough? Should we do a little listen?
Beth, I was wondering if I could have a piece of bread.
You can absolutely have a piece of bread. Okay, you guys dive into these onion rolls. We're going to listen to a little bit of music.
All right.
It's amazing, right?
Roll. Yeah.
Here's the music by Animals in the Attic. Sacramento band Animals in the Attic. They're about to release a new record this week. It is Naked in Public Part 2, which implies there was a Naked in Public Part 1. And yep. Absolutely there was.
Yes.
Spencer, do you want to talk a little bit about the music on the EP, right? 4 songs?
Yeah. So I guess it started because we've noticed a lot of bands releasing EPs, and I think our generation has a pretty short attention span with a lot of things, like listening to a full album by an upcoming band. So we decided to release the album in a 3-part trilogy. So we had Naked in Public Part 1, and then this is going to be Part 2, and then we'll have a Part 3.
And Naked in Public came from, I have to ask?
I'd say the vulnerability of the album. Just, yeah.
That's lovely. That's better than any other answer might be. So let me introduce you again, Spencer Rakella.
Yeah.
All right. And we have Jeff Luoma. We have Clayton LaFlamme here. Clayton's recording everybody, by the way. So
yeah, just to let you guys know, I'm recording.
I see a post in the future. Now you just made it legal, right?
Yeah,
to let us know.
That was me. Yep.
And Stefan Sorgi. You're all in your early 20s?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Were you high school friends?
Yeah. Spencer and I, we knew each other in middle school. We played in band together.
Cool.
But we really didn't start hanging out till high school. And then we started playing music together. It was
all
really
right.
Fun.
Yeah.
And the other two, Jeff?
Spencer and I met doing some shenanigans later in high school. Then realized, you know, he played music and I used to play music a little bit. And so I picked it back up and he introduced me to Clayton.
Jeff was an injured jock trying to make his way back into music.
You don't look like a jock anymore.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you're fit like a jock, but you look more like a musician.
I would say, I'd like to say that I've changed.
Were there shenanigans on the road, Stefan? Are they still at it?
So I actually was not able to go on the road. So, okay. But I'm guessing there must have been some shenanigans happening.
I want to let everybody know that you have a party coming up. Who's going to tell me the party details this weekend?
Thursday at Highwater.
Yeah, Thursday at Highwater, 9 p.m. It's a bar downtown, and we're doing an EP release show there.
Okay, Animals in the Attic. There's more online at capradio.org/insight. Thanks, guys. Great to have your music and you here.
Thank you.
Good luck. Thanks. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.